Oh, good. He came back first try.
We sent him away to get his drinks. And he came right back.
Good job. Good job.
He's getting
Craig.
Better. He's getting better. He deserves a rave. Let's double his pay.
Hell yeah, double of zero, still zero.
What was the first time you heard that joke?
What, the double of zero is still zero?
Double his pay. What's double zero? What's I get paid zero. What's double that?
Honestly, probably Three Stooges. I don't know if they ever did that, but it sounds like a Stooges joke.
It sounds like a Stooges joke. I can remember it vividly in my head for some reason. It was Shredder talking to Bebop and Rocksteady. And he goes to him and goes, if you catch the turtles for me, I'll double your pay. He's like, they're like, all right, yeah. And then Rocksteady turns to Bebop and goes, so what's double of nothing?
I still sort of remember from the Street Fighter movie. I can't remember who it was who was talking to Bison, you know, where he mentions that they get paid or something, and then Zangief is like, you get paid? Like, Zangief's been working for him this whole time without getting paid.
Such a Zangief thing to do.
Yeah, at least from that movie it was.
In that Street Fighter movie, I'm sure you're talking about the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, right?
Yeah, the greatest one ever made.
Yeah. The funniest joke ever put to film, I think, is in that film. Okay.
Is it the scene between Bison and Chun-Li?
No. It's when the bad guys are kind of like in like a restaurant or a building, and they're watching this like TV video of like this van just barrel through all these buildings coming straight towards them.
Right.
And like the scene's cutting around to like outside with everything, and it cuts back on the inside. They're watching the TV, and it cuts back to the outside with the truck barreling through full of explosives, and it cuts back inside to the TV, and the Zangief goes, "Quick, change the channel."
That's right. I had forgot about that. Oh my God, Zangief was the best thing in that movie besides Raul Julia.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm here to chew the scenery for 4 hours, but this movie's only an hour and a half. Nope. So this is a Street Fighter podcast now.
Yep. Well, welcome to the Street Fighters podcast, where we talk about all things Street Fighter, including the best Street Fighter movie ever made. So
that's a horrible introduction.
But no, that was a great introduction. If we haven't already lost every one of our listeners.
I'm Christopher.
Thing. Hi, guys. I'm Jay. Welcome to the Grumpy Dungeon Masters podcast. So, I have been looking through some old D&D material, as I love to do, as you're well aware. And I came across the Dungeons & Dragons Basic, the Book of Marvelous Magic, which was written by Frank Mentzer and Gary Gygax.
Okay.
All right. Now, it's nothing but just a book of random magic items that these two came up with and threw in a book. Some of them are good, some of them are not. Probably a quarter of them are cursed magic items. I specifically wanted to talk about this because of one item. It's the very first item in the book called Alternate World Gate. And this is, it's a bunch of different magic items you could potentially find. So you know how we talk a lot about the upcoming Spelljammer, Planescape, crossover of all the different campaign settings type thing that's going on?
Yeah, multiverse.
Yeah, the D&D multiverse, as it were. And, you know, Spelljammer was second edition. So it's been, that whole idea has been around a long time. But we still sort of always think of Forgotten Realms as Forgotten Realms, Dragonlance as Dragonlance, Dark Sun as Dark Sun, etc. But they're all still very Dungeons & Dragons settings. You know, for a character to come over from Dragonlance to Forgotten Realms, it's still a sort of medieval setting, so it's not a huge alteration. Gary Gygax and this Frank Mentzer guy did not seem to care whatsoever about the styles of crossovers in game settings. So Some of these, like, I'm just going to read through the alternate world gate stuff to get you on board with what I'm talking about here. These are various odd, unfamiliar items. When touched, each item gate or summons a being from an alternate world who appears within one turn. At that time, a door appears near the item, even if in midair, and a being steps through the door, grabs the item before the characters can react, even if it is apparently secured, stored, or held, and steps back through the doorway. If the characters react quickly, you may allow them to step through the door and arrive in the alternate world. Once in such a world, the characters must locate a gem of returning to return to the D&D game world. The characters might not remain human after passing through the gate, depending on the alternate world they visit. You and the players can discuss the change at that time. Severe changes should be optional, not forced. So, a list of the items that you could find is a blackjack, a laser pistol, a lute, a medal, a pocket tool, a star, or a violin case. And every one of these takes you to another ESR game setting. So if you found like the blackjack, you end up in the top secret game world. So you can literally take a D&D character and play James Bond.
All right, I'm all for that.
Yeah, laser pistol takes you to Gamma World. The loot would take you from basic Dungeons & Dragons to advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
Yeah, the medal takes you to Dawn Patrol, which was a ace pilot flying tabletop game, apparently. The pocket tool would take you to the Star Frontiers game, which is, you know, space.
Mm-hmm.
The star, this silver five-pointed item is apparently a brooch. And it summons a sheriff from the Boot Hill game, which is literally the Old West.
Okay.
And yeah, I love that one. And the violin case, this strangely shaped box has three hasps. If opened, a golden furry lining is seen, but the box is empty. Both the lining and the material of the box are unfamiliar. This case summons a thug from the Gangbusters game. A human clad entirely in black, wearing a cloth hat, and carrying an odd-looking metal tube with two handles and a large rounded middle. He may wave the device around threateningly, but will not attack and cannot speak intelligently.
Hey, what is that?
Gangbusters? Sounds like 1920s, like Al Capone gangsters.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fact is that this guy shows up in a suit carrying around a Tommy gun.
So it's... Okay, yeah. I'm actually looking forward to that, by the way.
You actually going to do something like this?
No, not the next Magic the Gathering set, but the one after that is Streets of Capernia.
Uh-oh.
Which is 1920 Devil versus Angel Gangsters, I believe.
Oh, that's right. You mentioned this, and I hate every second of that. Ugh.
Well, I just want a 1920s Magic the Gathering set because I know for some stupid reason that it's going to be a D&D setting. I mean, at this point in time, every setting in Magic the Gathering, shy of Innistrad, well, that's just Strahd with a couple with an inn in front of it, is a setting in Magic the Gathering. So, you know, I mean, why not? Why not just keep it going? Keep the crossover promotions going.
I wish I could continue to bitch about the crossovers, but I'm sitting here reading a book written by the godfather of D&D doing crossovers. So,
well, I mean, there's a right way to handle it and there's a wrong way to handle it, you know?
Oh, sure there is. Especially in D&D, like everybody's game, you can run your game however the hell you want. You know, I will never allow stuff like that in my own campaign world. If I'm running one of these other campaign worlds, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It gives you an opportunity to move on as well too.
Yeah. Like, so long time ago, I was like, 19, 20, somewhere around that age. And the group I was playing with at the time, our dungeon master, his name was Mike. He was a super creative DM and loved just to have fun with things. And he would do things like this. He'd been playing a long time, so honestly, he probably had read these books and such. And I know some of the magic items we found in his campaign were incredibly surreal to the fact that they could actually summon our real life selves into the game.
Okay.
Yeah. So I used to drive this gigantic, like, black van, just 2-door black van, no windows in the thing. And one of the magic items that one of the players had, when they used it like once per month or something or other, it could summon me into the game. I'd drive over the monster with the van and disappear through another portal.
I wonder what the name of this item was.
I wish I had a clue.
Jay's magic van.
Yeah, it was probably the stone of samurai summoning or something.
I hope it's a stone of samurai summoning. I hope it's specifically that's what it says, and then some dumbass uses it. It's like, oh, we're gonna get a samurai to help us out, and it's just some fucking ginger in a van that drives somebody over this finger out the window as they go by, and everyone's just more confused at the end of the day because of it.
Just giving them the finger as I run by.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I have no idea what he called the item. But everybody in that game could be summoned in through items. And it was basically like a Final Fantasy summon attack. You know, you just show up, do one attack, and then you're out of there.
Yeah, I love Final Fantasy summons as a concept. Oh, yeah. And absolutely. As a core material. I just wish they weren't 10 minutes long.
Well, at least in Final Fantasy VII, you could turn that off where they were a lot shorter. Thank goodness.
Yeah, but then with the full effect, like I think that they were so powerful, but it took a long time, and that was like the downside to them. It's like, oh, you want to one shot this battle? All right, well, it's going to take 10 minutes. Here comes Knights of the Round.
Yeah, you know? And it literally was about 10 minutes. But yeah, that was the thing. After you've seen it a couple of times, you're like, cool, I got it. Now we're going to skip it.
I don't think you could skip it in the original version, yes, but I know could. In the future versions you could.
Yeah, you absolutely could skip it in the original, because that was the only version I ever played.
I still know that it was either 11 or 13 summons of Knights of the Round plus one Phoenix to kill the Ruby weapon.
Oh my goodness. No, it took... To kill Ruby in Final Fantasy VII, the original one, was it was like 10 summons of Knights of the Round or something.
Yeah, it was 11 or 13 plus one Phoenix summon.
Yeah, it was a lot.
The concept was, everyone's like, oh, we got to beat the Ruby weapon. We got to beat the Ruby weapon. Like, no. It gives you a whole crap ton of experience and the level ups from Materia. So it's all about what can you actually, like, game out of it in that one time you get to beat it. So we would start with, like, two party members at one hit point. But they had all like the triple XP materia gaining materias and all the materials you want to level up, like the big expensive ones, the late game ones. And he would like do his like tentacle slash and like just kill them instantly.
Right.
So instead of being sucked into the world sand and taken out of the match, that they just died instantly and fell down. So that's when the 13 Knights of the Rounds kicked in. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, then it triggers everything.
Right. And then you do that one Phoenix. And that Phoenix was enough to kill Ruby weapon and raise your party at the same time. Thus, everyone gets the experience and everyone gets the level up from Materia.
Like the Magic the Gathering timing bullshit.
Pretty much, yeah. Took us forever to figure that out, but we figured it out.
Yeah. I don't remember which one of the weapons I beat. There were two of them. I definitely beat one of them. The other one, I beat the game and then just like, I don't want to go back and do it. It's too much work.
There was one underwater and there was one in the desert.
Yeah. I can't recall which one I killed.
Everyone beat the one under the water. It's pretty easy because you have your full team.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Ruby Weapon is literally just in the sand. You lose two party members immediately. And it's just 1v1. So people had more. That was the harder one.
Yeah. You pretty much had to run the right combination, I would guess, to beat it.
Yeah, that's where the 13 Knights of the Rounds came in.
Yep. But now, hell, that would be awesome if you had something like that in Dungeons & Dragons. Like, the summons obviously exist, but they're kind of weak most of the time. You know, I don't know, just like the whole idea of conjuring in the game rarely ever works out well. It's either super busted or useless. And this, well, the super busted is the summon 16 birds, get 16 attacks in a round. You know, that kind of nonsense. But
well, I can say that in my Owl campaign, they finished up the Act boss for Act 3.
Mm-hmm.
And before they went to the Act boss, they actually did find like the treasure vault that I had set aside for them, which was a whole crap ton of items. I actually went and rolled every single one out per the DMG just to see what I would get. And I think I changed maybe one or two of the items just because I didn't like the item that was there. It was kind of useless. But all in all, in the treasure room at the very end, they found 24 gems worth 1,000 silver apiece, oil of slipperiness, an elemental gem of emerald, because they're in a place that just emeralds everywhere.
Yeah.
A robe of useful items, potion of hill giant strength, 5 art objects worth 2,500 silver each, a figurine of the serpentine owl, the armor of resistance acid, a ring of protection, necklace of prayer beads, which I call the necklace of acorns just for like a thematic flair.
All right.
And so they're outside the room where they know the boss is in, because there's only like 2 doors, and they found the treasure door, and you know, they hear chanting on the other side of the other door. So they go to the robe of useless items, or useful items.
It's the robe of useless items, let's be honest.
And he's like, oh, I can summon a bunch of mastiffs. Hold on. Rips off a bunch of patches, summons a bunch of mastiffs. He's like, all right, we got this. The dogs will help.
Yeah, if you get lucky, if you manage to get the same one, because if you know it's all rolled up randomly, if you get a whole bunch of the mastiffs, all right, that might be so useful.
I think he summoned like 2 or 4 mastiffs.
Yeah,
and I
mean, a couple of them's okay. 4 of them would be, that'd be nice.
Right. So they started the encounter. I think there was one person that went before my ancient Fomorian mage is what I rolled up. Okay.
Yeah.
And he looked at him and was just like, black tentacles. And so it goes off. They all make their saves. Every mastiff dies.
Oh.
I was just like, oh, well, it was a good try.
Yeah.
Good try.
That's proving my point.
All the masters are gone. Yep. And like they had like they even went for parts like, you know, enlarging a couple of the mastiffs to make them bigger and stuff like that to kind of help out. Black tentacles.
Yeah, what they didn't realize is the mastiffs have like, you know, 16 hit points or something like that.
5 hit points.
Oh, geez, even worse.
I know.
So talking about magic items, I just started playing around some with the level up advanced 5e stuff. I decided to hand out a few magic items from it this past weekend.
Yeah.
And like most of them are very, very minor things that I'm not even going to talk about. But one of them I handed out is kind of awesome. And after I read the description, you'll know what this is. At least I think you will. So it's called Echo Force, and it's a short sword that looks like a shard from a shattered mirror.
Mm-hmm.
While you are attuned to and wielding this short sword and at your hit point maximum, instead of making a melee weapon attack, you can strike at the air to create a blade of magical force. Your blades are magical force, are ranged to spell attacks that use strength or dexterity, your choice, and have a range of 30 to 60 feet and deal 1d6 force damage. When you are not at your hit point maximum, this short sword becomes a mundane item.
Huh. It's Link's sword.
Yeah, it's literally Link's sword that they've created for this game. And I like the fact that it does that. Yeah, I think the rogue has it, if I recall right.
Yeah.
You know, which that just makes sense. It's a short sword already. And now he has he was already using a short bow, but now he doesn't have to. He could just do sneak attacks from 30 to 60 feet away.
Yeah, if he's at his hit point maximum.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the time he will be, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. At least at the beginning of the fight, most of the time he will be.
I mean, I don't remember ever being able to use Link's range attack, because I was never at full hit points.
I used it a lot in the first game.
Yeah, because if you didn't have it, you were dead.
Yep. No, there's some other items. I don't.
I want to hear about the armchair again because you like it so.
Oh yeah. I talked to you about that. I love this thing, man. Back. We're actually flipping back from the Advanced 5e to the Book of Marvelous Magic. Come on, you can't tell me that chair is not awesome. Where is it? Chair.
Sorry, you haven't memorized it by now. You've told us. You've told me like three. You've talked about it three separate times.
I talked about it. I have talked about it three separate times. You were not there for the third one. I can't find it.
If I remember correctly, it was an armchair which you, when you used it and sat down.
I know what it does. I could explain it just fine, but I want
explain
to
explain it.
Screw it. All right. Yeah. So there's an item in here called the Armchair of Restfulness. And basically, once per day, you can sit down in the chair and you will actually, it actually teleports you to an outer dimension. And then 10 minutes later, you come back as if though you have had a full night's rest. I think everybody in the world wants one of these.
Like, I do for sure.
Screw D&D. Like, if I had a chair that I could just plop down in for 10 minutes and I've had a full night's rest, that's literally the greatest thing to exist ever. Better than sliced bread. It's better than your mama's cornbread or mac and cheese. It's amazing.
Yep. I'd do it even one better. Like, I would take a magical chair that would basically just sum it up as I wanted it to be there when I sat down. You know, so like, I'm like, oh man, I wish I could sit down. And I just start sitting down and a chair just appears underneath me and just catches me, you know?
Yeah, that'd be nice too. Especially if it was also one of restfulness.
I mean, I would take that. I would use it no matter what I'm doing. Like, it would be in the middle of like LARPing and at Shadowmoor. I'd be like, I gotta sit. Here we go. Bam. Screw your log. I got a giant comfy chair.
You just need to hire you a chair boy. Just chair boy. Hire, yeah, chair boy. Just hire somebody to walk around behind you all the time, just toting a chair. That's it. I actually know somebody from the LARP who used to actually do that. They had a chair boy. Just follow them around. You know, they attack things and play, you know, through spells and stuff, but their primary function was to carry that chair around.
Yeah. I don't have to be a big chair. Like, I wanted to be like a big, like, lazy boy though.
Yeah. I mean, have
strap it to his back.
I mean, the chair that you actually use at Shadowmoor is like that. My feet barely touch the ground sitting in it. I am not a small man by any means.
Yeah, it's rated for 1,000 pounds, man.
Yeah. That's five of me? That's more than five of me.
The best part is, too, is when I first bought that chair, I was reading the reviews, and one person put it, goes, definitely doesn't hold 1,000 pounds. Me and my hubby were sitting in it, and it broke. So, like, either you're lying about your weight, or you and your hubby were not sitting in the chair.
Yeah, they were trying a little something else.
I prefer to think of it as they were just very round and they sat in the chair and just went flattened.
Yep. Can't do it. Too much. Too much.
But yeah, I wouldn't mind that magic chair. It just appeared everywhere. The sleep, like the 10-minute rest thing, man, that'd be interesting. I'm sure like all mages have something like that, you know.
Oh yeah, if you're a high end mage and you've got money to burn, your whole like power would be full of stuff like that. Like, I'm sitting here reading, just flipping through. There's like magic soap in this thing.
Why do you need magic soap when you got prestidigitation?
Well, I don't know if they didn't have cantrips in basic D&D. So casting prestidigitation, you actually had to cast a proper spell.
It's a 10-minute ritual that requires hot water and animal fat.
Well, this one's called the soap of washing. The small brownish cake of soap will, when placed into a bucket or tub of water, dissolve completely. The water then becomes magical. Any item or creature placed within or doused by the water becomes completely clean. removes all normal and magical stains and dyes, and can even remove curses. However, it affects only curses removable by a remove curse spell from a caster of 21st level or less. Mind you, that's probably the equivalent of like 10th level in 5e terms.
Uh-huh.
The soap washes any number of normal items, its effect lasting for 1 hour.
That's just a bath bomb, dude. I mean, they have those right now.
I know, right? honestly, the bath bomb might be a good way to remove curses.
Removes a lot of stuff.
You get that dye that just keeps rolling ones. That's cursed. Throw that in the bath bomb, man. That'll fix it.
Hey guys, Chris here, hopping in the middle of the podcast to give you all of our announcements. Be sure to watch our live stream every Saturday at Twitch, twitch.tv/GrumpyDungeonMasters at 8 p.m. Make sure to visit our website, grumpydungeonmasters.com, and order yourself one of our gift packs of Grumpy Dungeon Master dice. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/GrumpyDungeonMasters, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at GrumpyDMs on Twitter. Be sure to check out our new buddies, Fate Awakens, on YouTube at youtube.com/FateAwakens. And also be sure to tune in every Friday at 4 p.m. when they release their new live play D&D session of their homebrew campaign. As always, be sure to check out Zenergy Gamers at zenergy-gamers.com. Use code WordGrumpy for 5% off any online order. Anything else to add, Jay?
Nope. Just over here dancing on TikTok.
All right. That brings up another story I want to tell.
All right, go for it.
Okay, well, so I mentioned earlier that they fought the big bad end guy to my owl campaign.
Yeah. Right?
And like I said, it was an ancient Vermorian wizard. And Vermorians are already pretty well hard to beat, okay? And they also went into it down a person. So in order to explain that, I have to tell another quick story.
I love stories inside of a story.
So my wife's character got a message saying, hey, I need you to find a black book and bring it back to me. And they were looking for it, and they found the room where the black book is being held is being guarded by Invisor, the bloodshot eye spectator, his rainbow-colored displacer beast called Sprinkles, and a couple of emerald golems.
That's right. I forgot about Sprinkles.
So they start fighting over that. And if everyone wanted to know, Invisor is a large spectator. So I upped the stats a little bit. He's a little bit more health, has a legendary resistance on him, and has a single legendary action, which will be explained in a little bit. So he starts doing his eye beam thing, and the spectators only have 4 eye beams compared to the 8 that a beholder has. And he doesn't have disintegrate ray. They're fighting everything. They're ignoring the spectator because he's just whiffing all of his eye beams. You know, they're level 6 now. DC 13 is pretty easy to beat. But they're passing all the things successfully. They're fighting the displacer beast. They kill the emerald golems almost instantly. And my wife has been playing this artificer since level 1. And she built it with the idea of basically using the feat that lets you take a -5 to your attack roll to add 10 damage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know that one all too well.
Yeah. But, you know, in order to do that, she has to get advantage somehow on the target. So she fairy fires everybody first. Okay?
Makes sense.
She usually goes first. She usually fairy fires everybody. And it's not a bad spell way to start a fight, you know?
Yeah, if it sticks on a bunch of things, it's real good.
More often than not, it did. So she casts Fairy Fire on the Displacer Beast, okay? And so the Displacer Beast failed and is glowing, which was amazing that the Displacer Beast failed.
Yep.
A spell. I think I rolled like 2 twos or some
crap. Yeah, I don't think it gets rid of his blur effect, but it's effectively going to negate it, so it'll be straight rolls.
And then it was flanked on top of that.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
So she cast a fairy fire on it. It landed. It stuck. And for those of you who don't know, the Splinter Beast has an ability that if it can make a saving throw, it has advantage on that saving throw. Mm-hmm. And it still failed on a dex save. And it's good at dex. So
it happens, man. It happens.
So the group gets an entire round just to beat on this displacer beast. And it gets back around to my wife. And my wife is like, okay, I finally get to use my shots with the minus 5, plus 10 infusion to it. So she takes a couple shots, and both of them hit. This is the first time her attacks have hit since the start of the campaign this way.
Okay.
She has never hit anybody when she decided to do the minus 5 on it. Never. And she hit the displacer beast back to back and did something like 28 and another 28 damage. Some ridiculous amount of damage.
Yeah, I mean, that's most of its hit points right there.
She killed the displacer beast. Now back to Invisor. Invisor had one legendary action. When Sprinkles dies, he enrages. And his giant central bloodshot eye invokes the will of beholders before him, and he fires one disintegrate ray at the person that killed Sprinkles.
Oh no.
It hit my wife.
Of course it did.
It did 39 force damage. Her max hit points are 37.
Oh no.
She had nothing but dust.
She
had been talking to me about wanting to leave the campaign for a little bit because holidays and stuff, so like there's a good period of time where she wants to get her Saturdays back for a little bit.
Sure.
So, and she was like, we took a break. I was like, hey, you're dead. Do you want to come back or you just want to take a break for a little while? She's like, I'm taking the break. So, the wife is gone. I just disintegrated her out of the campaign. So, wasn't planned. But it's a beautiful way to go out.
It worked out. And honestly, it's a beautiful death.
Yes.
There's no better way to die in a Dungeons & Dragons campaign, I think, than killing Sprinkles and getting disintegrated for it.
I need a shirt that says that. I killed Sprinkles and all I got was disintegrated.
Yeah, and it needs to be the dead body of a rainbow displacer beast with a pile of dust next to it. So that nobody understands it other than us and, you know, people who watch the stream.
So she's out of the campaign. So when they actually got the next fight, honestly, was the big bad boss. They had cleared everything else out. So they get into the fight. They're down their artillery cannon, essentially. And they did really well. They started off pretty hard. They casted haste on the barbarian, as you do. The barbarian can fly, as owls do.
Yep.
And he was wrecking house on that Fomorian. And I wasn't holding back. I gave it kind of like the basic legendary actions. Like at the end of everyone's turn, he could make a melee attack. You know, normally that's useless for a mage, but it's a Fomorian, so. It's got this giant club of a mace, and it still has 23 strength. So it's like, dang.
That's a lot of damage.
It's a lot of damage, yeah. So it's casting a spell and then like melee attacking three times. You know, like, because, you know, why not if you're a giant? I used the eye. I gave it its base eye attack, the one base eye attack, and I gave it two uses of a legendary eye as well. Okay, so it got three total the whole fight. And all you gotta do is pass a measly DC 14 charisma save. That's easy, right?
It depends on what the class and so forth is. You know, if like asking a fighter make a DC 14 intelligence save, not all that great.
Right. Well, I'm proud to say that no one passed.
Oh, jeez.
It took the cleric out second round. But the third round, they were able to get the Fomorian down to bloodied, and he did this giant AoE shadow knockback attack when it hit bloodied.
Yeah.
And that was the first death failure for the cleric. It had two successes by that point. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, his turn was immediately after the Fomorian's knockback, and he rolled a one.
Of course he did.
So now here's two characters dead in the span of like less than 2 hours.
You have this magical knack for just killing characters. I don't know what it is.
That's not my fault. A player rolling a one on a death save is not my fault.
It's your fault.
So the haste fell, the concentration for haste fell, so the barbarian was out for a full round.
Yeah, and he's exhausted, I think it is.
Yeah. So they're doing their best. The ranger can't do anything because he's slowed, and the Fomorian teleported out of his melee range. And sorry, the Fomorian started attacking the mage of the group. And I crit on that melee attack. I decided to basically stop swinging it one-handed and start swinging it two-handed. So the die size went up one. And that's when I crit. So 48 plus 6 damage, I think. Yeah. Took the mage out right there. So the mage was down. The ranger hobbles over. He picks the mage back up. The robe of useless items had 4 healing potions in it.
Always nice. So,
yeah, very nice. So he brought up the mage. The Fomorian teleported away again. Everyone's kind of like rushing over to kind of get to the Fomorian to fight him. The mage just got picked up by a health potion. He cast one spell. It missed. And then the Fomorian fireballs them.
Oh, jeez.
So the mage goes right back down. but, you know, it didn't have any special resistance. It had shield. But that was about it. I used counterspell to counterspell somebody else's shield. So, yeah, but they were able to actually finally beat it.
Honestly, I think that's a good use of counterspell because I really hate the shield spell.
Yeah. I was like, can I counterspell that? It's my turn. Yeah, yes, I guess I can.
You can counterspell any spell as long as you're within the, you know, predetermined distance of it.
So at the end of the fight, and that was the end of the stream for the night, the barbarian was the only one left standing with 9 hit points. The ranger was just got knocked down, and the mage was knocked down. But they had all the health potions, so like they would have picked up by the time it failed.
Yeah.
And that's where we ended it, and then they got a preview of the boss, the final boss.
I hope they get the heal before fighting.
Well, they have a whole other act to go through before they fight it.
Oh, okay, good then.
Yeah, there's three more beats to the final thing. There's basically going back to town, getting the final MacGuffin, fixing the final MacGuffin, and then fighting the boss.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of gave him the description of the boss. I'll actually read it off real quick.
Yeah, I know what it is, as you've already.
But just let me know if you can figure it out from this description.
Yeah.
The room. I have to fix my spelling because it messes me up so much. The room grows dark, leaving only shadows. And then 2 eyes made of pure fire appear. A shadow twists and turns, revealing a large gargantuan dragon. Silver teeth are revealed from its head. It's round. I forgot. I didn't save my proper cup. Anyways, so silver teeth are shown in a large round head. Shadowy whisker-like hair and long antennae jut out from the top of its head. Its long neck forms straggly limbs and wings. Its fingers grow like long insect claws and a long tail that snaps back and forth. Snaps in the wind. I'm terrible at writing and reading at 10 o'clock at night. I tried to get everything in there about it. It was much better on the stream when I read it because I had the right copy. I'm embarrassed.
It'll be fine. I think people can get the gist of it.
I hope they got the gist of it. What the end boss is. If not, they're going to be surprised.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything. I want to say something, but I'm not going to say anything. Because spoilers. Spoilers are bad.
Yeah.
Don't do spoilers. Also, go watch the new Ghostbusters because it's amazing. Amazing, amazing. Yeah, I almost had a complete party wipe this past weekend as well. Like yours was closer than mine was, but mine was, it was getting a little dicey for them. So my players, it had been a month or so since I'd gotten to run, so we sort of had to pick things back up. They finished out the last leg of what they were doing. They were heading back to town to do some other stuff, and I sent them on a little side quest. I mentioned it to you last night. So I sent my players on an escort mission. You ever run an escort mission in D&D?
No, because I hate them in WoW.
I know, right? I detest escort missions, so I had to send my players on one. They ended up picking up 5 hobgoblin trainees. They're basically first level. One of them was second level, but they're first level monks. And they were tasked with going to the top of the mountain and returning with the scale of a beast that lives up at the top of the mountain. They don't have a description of what this thing is. They don't know what it is, just that they're supposed to go to this cavern and return back with it. So my players find their way up the mountain with these 5 hobgoblins in tow. My players are 6th level. And, you know, nobody dies on the way up. And they get into the cavern, and the first thing they come across is a Zorn. You know, X-O-R-N, the 3-legged, 3-armed creature with 3 eyeballs and a giant mouth on the top of its head from the plane of Earth.
I only know what they are because of the Magic the Gathering set.
Oh, okay. Well, Zorns, they're not generally super aggressive in the first place unless they're starving to death. This one was not. One thing they will do, though, is they will barter with people. So if they find things like magic items that they actually cannot consume, they will sell magic items or food. And they basically consume rare gems, gold, things like that. So this thing, it can't talk. It just sort of has to make motions. My players were able to figure out that it wants their gold and it'll give them things for it. So they got a few magic items. You know, that I already said I'm not going to go over them tonight. But one of them was the sword that I mentioned earlier and a couple other things from it. And then they asked the Zorn, where did he find the magic items at? So he creates another tunnel. They follow him through. And he pretty much leads them to a bunch of dead bodies. So they decide to go down that tunnel a little further, and they see a couple of salamanders around the corner. Now, my players are level 6. They've got the 5 level 1s with them. So they saw the 2 salamanders. They end up attacking them. Now, my players at level 6, salamanders are CR5. 2 of them, not a problem. They get around the corner and in the room, and there's 6 salamanders. So it's 5 players at level 6 versus 6 salamanders, CR5, and they got a bunch of level 1 monks with them. This is going to be a rough-ass fight, and that's exactly what I wanted it to be. And the, okay. So salamanders, they do reasonable damage when they attack. You know, it's like 2d6 plus the strength bonus, and they do, I think it's 2d6 fire damage when they hit. It's either 1d6 or 2d6 when they hit. But they also deal fire damage when somebody hits them. So the PC monk goes in, lights one of these things up, and then takes like 35 damage just from attacking. So okay. he's at like 2 hit points after the first round of combat. At that point, he just starts, oh, this ain't working. And from that point forward, he just stayed away from them and threw things at them. The other monks, they all run in. And oddly enough, they might only be level 1s, but they were able to put out some pretty good damage. And somehow they magically were not taking much damage in return. I kept rolling like 1, you know, 2 points, 3 points. So by the end of this combat, they had ended up, 2 of the monks were down. The other 3 never dropped. and none of the PCs dropped. Two of the PCs were at like 2 hit points. Everyone was like had soaked up a lot of damage in this fight. And that's one of those fights, man, that I feel if one thing had gone wrong, the whole party could have just wiped out real easy.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with me to either. Like, why is every fight that I do this with a boss always ends at almost near TPK? I mean, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I honestly have no idea. My players keep coming back, so I'm assuming it's a good thing.
It is. It's players like a challenge. If they go to every single fight and steamroll every single fight all the time, most players are not going to be okay with that. Yeah, they generally want something of a challenge. You know, some fights they should steamroll, some fights they should get the shit kicked out of them, but survive. It's the trick of the DM is finding that sort of balance point of, you know, make this challenge encounter difficult, but not kill everybody. And
well,
even
that's the thing is that
even using CRs is hard.
That's the thing in D&D though, is like if they fail, they're dead. I mean, there's a couple times where, like, you could say they got captured and, you know, they were stabilized or whatever. But, I mean, if they fail, they're dead. If it's a party of drow ambushes them and takes them out, they're dead. There's no, the drow aren't going to save them, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I guess I'd have to write in, like, what would happen and then, like, have, like, this extra campaign, like, you know, to be sold into, like,
you wouldn't be the you would not be the first person to do this. Campaigns go awry all the time. We, you know, I was playing in the pirate campaign before COVID, and we ended up on the plane of water because of one random accidental roll that ended. You know, we ended up in a whirlpool in a random encounter, ended up on the plane of water with no way to get back.
Yeah.
So sometimes shit just goes awry, and the DM has to figure out, well, fuck, what do I do now?
Yeah, but I definitely can't do that midstream, you know? Like, if they TPK'd in the Fomorian Mage, cool, like, they can pick up with new characters back in town, and we go into the end game, you know?
Yeah, doing it on stream is a whole other animal, yes.
If they're doing Waterdeep, they get thrown in prison, you know, there's a couple outs there, but... Mm-hmm. Straw just eats them. I mean,
yeah, and it is also a very I can't help but harken back to the changes from the early editions to where we're at now. It was nothing to go through multiple characters over the course of a campaign in first or second ed. Like it was almost expected. You know, after you got high enough rank, high enough level, and had enough money, maybe you could get resurrected. But TPKs were pretty common. Now I don't really hardly ever see them. Even on streams, you don't really see it. Like, TPKs are just incredibly rare, it seems. And I think that's just a change of the rules from 5th edition to the early editions.
Yeah, like I said, I don't mind killing players as much as I hate doing it. I don't mind it because it happens.
Yeah.
And I think the group that I have is pretty good with, you know, rolling with the punches, as it were, you know. But it's still something that I struggle with. You know, in Adventures League, it's kind of easy. You just spend 100 gold and your character's back. Ooh.
Yeah.
But in Adventures League, it's like, we couldn't arrest Shelley's character if we wanted to because there was nothing left of her body.
Yeah. That's wholly up on the DM as to how they want to handle that. Like, true resurrection, even if you get disintegrated, you know, you could still bring somebody back with that.
Yeah. True resurrection was the one we went out, but in a campaign setting where I'm not having any, you know, clerics as a normal thing, you know, it's kind of hard to have that. You can't even regenerate her. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, regenerate is a druid spell, but yeah, no, I get it. If you're disintegrated, you're probably just done.
So I guess maybe the thing I should take away from it is not give Invisor disintegrate beam and give him the wounding ray instead.
Oh, I think give him the disintegrate ray. There has to be that threat level. Yeah, if they don't kill Sprinkles first, not a problem.
Yeah, but they won't know that.
that is correct, and that provides a certain level of threat, you know?
Fair enough.
It's not like it, you know, and they could still make the save. Maybe they hit the fighter with it who has a lot more hit points. There's a million ways to survive it. It just happened in that case, they didn't.
Yeah, my group seems to have very few hit points in this campaign, and they're rolling just normal hit point rules. It's really weird.
It is. Look, man, the monk in my campaign has, at level 6 has like 39 hit points.
Yeah, that's pretty low.
That's definitely not normal.
Yeah, Shelly told me that she had 37, and for another guy to say, like, oh, yeah, Olive is 40, like, what's your guys' con score?
Yeah, exactly. It's not like Jacob doesn't even have a terrible con score. He's just rolled absolute garbage. And I let him take half. But he'd probably have less if I didn't allow that.
But yeah, so I'm kind of reflecting more now that I'm getting closer to the end. Like, what have I changed? What is really bad with how I ran the game on stream? What should I upgrade? What should I change?
I know, right? And it's like that test that you're doing. You have to test it out to see how it works. You're just doing it live in front of an audience.
Yeah. So I think I'm in a good spot overall. I got to flesh out like when they level up. They should be 7 now, essentially. Mm-hmm. I'm trying my best to keep the scope creep from snapping in, because there's just, I would love to keep running it, but no one's going to want to run a campaign. And it's, will be probably 23 sessions before they're done. So almost as much as Frostmaiden. I think Frostmaiden was like 26 or 28.
Right.
But we did run a lot of extra time in Act 2, which I think I've gone back and changed. So, I don't know. It's definitely been a huge experience, and a very different experience writing the campaign versus the one-shot. But I'm ready to get back to one-shots and really just expand the portfolio some more.
Yeah, we're likely to be doing some one-shots over the next month as well.
Yeah.
Around Christmas time, you know, people are here, people are there. Sometimes it can be hard to get everybody together. So we'll probably have at least one, if not two, one-shots over the course of the next month or so.
Yep, and then you guys got to run my L campaign for me and test it out.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
You don't want to run it next year?
No, I definitely do not. I have my own. Man, I've already got two other campaigns planned post this one. And this campaign is probably going to take most of next year, the one I'm currently running. So after
I'll
that,
let Jonathan run it then.
Yeah, there you go. After I finish the current campaign I'm running, yeah, my goal is to run them up to level 16 to level 20, somewhere in there. And they're level 6 right now, and I'm leveling them very slowly. But after that, I'm probably going to run a Dune campaign. Yeah, like the movie, like the books, the Frank Herbert books. Being that I finally picked up the book. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Did you use code word Grumpy for 5% off?
I got my 5% off, yes.
Did you use code word Grumpy?
I told them it was Grumpy Dungeon Masters, and they gave me money off. I'm assuming that's what he did.
I hope so.
It was your store, man. Talk to them about it. I don't know.
I'm honestly thinking, too, next time the RPG Writer Workshop comes around, they have a Cthulhu one-shot course. I may pick that up and do that.
You should. No, you should absolutely jump into that one, because Cthulhu is very different from D&D, and the way things are written is incredibly different. It is going to be much more akin to, it's just a lot less combat. Combat is, you do not want to do combat in Cthulhu. So it's going to have a lot more of the investigative aspects of things, and that would be incredibly useful. I may join in on that.
After seeing like Ghostbusters and seeing like all the maps and stuff they had in the end credits and shit, Like, that's all I wanted to do, was like a Call of Cthulhu modern day, a modern day Call of Cthulhu kind of campaign and world.
That would be fun. That would be awesome. Because
you didn't realize it in the Ghostbusters movie, but they answered the question of, like, why not just use your cell phone?
Yeah, and, you know, I never thought about them not using... Well, I guess I did, because they mentioned it briefly.
They mentioned it briefly on the way there. It's like,
right, yeah, yeah.
Finn picks it up and goes, man, not even one bar? And they're like, yeah, this place is in the middle of nowhere. It better be.
There better be at least one bar.
And there's no bars. Thus, no cell phones. Thus, the problem that all filmmakers and scriptwriters have to deal with is just gone. In a very logical way, because they're out in the middle of nowhere.
Yep. I had always thought about that if they had to reboot the movie The Thing, which is like my favorite movie of all time. If you ever wanted to do a new version of it, like a modern version of it, how do you answer the cell phone problems? And hey, that's how.
Yeah. Storms also work.
Yeah, storms work. Yeah, and if the thing took place up in it took place in Antarctica, so that's kind of remote.
All the satellite phones are dead.
Yeah. Well, they actually sort of answered that in the original movie. It actually went and destroyed. Or actually, I think it was Blair that went and destroyed a lot of the ability to contact other people. But they took care of that rather quickly within the film.
Yeah. And it's weird, too, because when you think about that problem from a D&D standpoint, no one brings the fact that anyone can just cast sending at any time.
Yes. Yep. Sending is a thing, and it honestly, like, if it's a high fantasy world where there's a lot of wizards, there would probably be, hell, there'd probably be a business that's just sitting there, a storefront that you can go in and, you know, send messages across the world. Like you would effectively have the telegraph already in wizards.
I guess the idea in a high fantasy world is the wizard's stuck in a cave. He just uses sending, sends a message out, and then a whole army comes and rescues him.
It could be a thing. It's like the Shadowrun, the dock wagon. You remember Cyberpunk, the game at the beginning. Yeah, it'd be like that. Oh, crap, we're in trouble. Next thing you know, here comes... a whole bunch of wizard, or like a gate just opens up next to you, wizard, and a bunch of, you know, warriors pour out and start killing the dragon.
You know what also wasn't available 50 years ago for a modern Cthulhu game?
What?
If you wanted to see a picture of a raccoon, you had to go either already have one or go to a library and find one.
Yes.
And if you wanted a picture of a raccoon in a funny hat, you're out of luck.
Yeah, you would have to go and capture a raccoon, take a picture of it with a funny hat on it.
So there's a lot more to think about in 1920s Cthulhu writing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
No internet.
Telephones, yes, but even then they were still, you know, it was call operator and they'll try to patch you through.
Hello, operator? I need to speak to the magistrate, quickly.
Yes, yeah, that's how it was done.
I'd actually probably, honestly, what I would do is I'd probably do Call of Cthulhu in like the 1940s, because I think I could do that. That'd be pretty easy, and I could just use old Stooges cartoons as a reference.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I know in the book, at least the one I've gotten, it's an earlier edition one of the Call of Cthulhu stuff, but it allows you three settings. I think it's 1880s. 1920s and then modern era.
Yeah.
And mind you, modern era, the book I have is from the 90s, so it's before cell phones.
Yep. Cell phones ruined everything, man.
Yeah, it made things,
cell phones' fault.
It made writing for stuff like this a lot harder.
Printed word on paper? What next? Now we don't need scribes?
Before we leave, I want to leave with one other ridiculous magic item from this Book of Marvelous Magic by Frank Mincer and Gary Gygax.
Okay.
It is a tub of fat. This tub appears identical to a tub of lard, but when commanded to produce lard, it causes the user to increase in weight by 50% instead. That's horrible. God. Yep. I'll go ahead and read the rest. Why not? The weight appears simply as extra pounds of flesh. The extra weight breaks the straps of any armor worn, causing it to fall off immediately. This does not harm any enchantments, and repairs are easily made by a leather worker for a moderate fee. Clothing worn beneath the armor bulges but is not harmed. The extra fat can be removed quickly, only with a cure-all spell, a wish, or a remove curse. I have to look. I got to figure out what the cure-all spell is. I don't know.
We have that in modern day. It's called McDonald's.
It's true. Cure-all spell.
I think I'm done. Not once we talked about the fat tub, the tub that makes people fat. I think I'm good. We could have ended this on raccoons wearing funny hats, but no. You had to take it to the fat tub, the tub that makes people fat.
I could end it with the kangaroo pout.
No.
So long. The grumpiness has been your friend. Now go and spread anger through D&D. No, don't do that. Be happy, be friendly, be awesome. But maintain the boiling hate that inside your heart. I don't know, buddy. I'm rambling at this point. Shut me up and end this podcast.